Masechet Baba Masiah Daf Nun Vav. The Mishnah mentioned five categories where one has to pay a 1/5 surcharge. And one of them is that if a non-Kohen eats Terumat Maaser of Demai, they have to pay a penalty of the whatever they ate plus a surcharge. And now this is interesting because Demai, one only has to take Terumat Maaser from it Me Derabanan. I mean, the same would be true for with the regular Terumah and the regular Maaser that Levi and Terumat Maaser. So this is Demai, so we don't know if the Mama Aretz took Terumat Maaser. Probably they did, but in case they didn't, the rabbis say, take Terumat Maaser. So this is only Terumat Maaser midirabanan, and yet if someone eats it, they have to add a surcharge. So the Gemara asks about that. Why is it so stringent, right? That the rabbis really make their own rabbinic laws so stringent that they would make it like a Torah law, and you have to add a fifth. That was Rabbi Elazar's question. Pay attention to the names of this back and forth. It's a long list of questions and answers, but it's going to be important to remember all the names. So Rabbi Elazar asked the first question. Shmuel answers that this Mishnah is according to the Bimei Meir. And the Bimei Meir, yes, that is his general opinion, that when there is a rabbinic enactment, the rabbis make it stringent like a Torah law. And the proof was from a get, that if you bring a messenger, brings a get from outside of Israel, all he has to say, if he doesn't say that, then according to the Bimei Meir, and she gets remarried, that's like adultery, and the child is considered a mamzer, even though on a doraita level, she got a get, and the child should be fine. Yet the rabbis make a rabbinic enactment, and they're going to say, well, if you didn't do it exactly the way the rabbi said and add this phrase, then it's like it's not a get, and we will consider that child to be a mamzer. So that's Shmuel's answer, that we're following the opinion of Rabbi Meir. Now, this is where we start with Rav Sheshat challenging that answer of Shmuel. Mativ Rav Sheshat, mechalalin oto kesef al kesef, nechoshet al nechoshet, kesef al nechoshet, unechoshet al perot, ve'yachzor v'yifteta perot, dibre Rabbi Meir. Hachamim omerim ya'alu perot v'yachilu birushalayim. If someone had demai produce, and they have to take maaser shenit, and the maaser sheni year. So, although this is only midrabanan, so still they do that. Now, they separate Maaser Sheni fruit from this demai, and now they don't want to carry the fruit to Jerusalem. They redeem it for money, and now that those coins that they have, they want to transfer the kedusha to yet another coin or back to fruit and so on. So here we see the laws that one can redeem a silver coin upon another silver coin, transfer the kedusha, or if it's on a copper coin, transfer it to another copper coin. You can even take silver and move the kedusha to a copper coin, and you can take copper coin and transfer the kedusha to produce. However, you have to make sure to then put it back, take the produce, the fruit, and put it back into a coin and then bring it to Jerusalem. The point is that whatever you bring to Jerusalem should be coins, because you're not bringing the original produce. If you brought the original produce, that's the best thing. Fantastic. But now that you put it onto coins, and whatever you do in between, you redeem it with money, and you bring the money to Jerusalem and then buy fruit there, according to the Bimei Meir. Chachamim, however, say, let's say you had original fruit demai, and then you put it onto money, and then you put it back onto fruit, you can carry that fruit to Jerusalem, and you don't have to redeem it again. All these are leniencies that are applied to demai. Now we ask, now is this true, that you can take silver and put it onto copper? מחוללת על מעות הללו. הוא בורר את היפה שבהן ומחללו עליה מפני שאמרו מחללין אותו כסף על נחושת מדוחק. לא שיקיים כן אלא שחוזר ומחללן על הכסף. So now we're going to ask, well, can you really do that? No, although you can do that with demai, now we're going to bring a Mishnah from Masechet Maaser Sheni. This is about regular Maaser Sheni Midoraita. And here we learn that, let's say, you had a silver coin of Maaser Sheni and another one of Chulin, and they got mixed up with each other, and they look the same, and you can't tell which one is which. So now you have one holy coin and one non-holy coin. So what are you going to do? So you could bring some copper coins and you say, wherever the Kiddushah is on the silver coin, whichever one it is, I want that Kiddushah to transfer on these copper coins over here. And then after you do that, now you have the copper coins that are Ma'aseh Sheni coins. Then you take the best, the nicest of the silver coins and you say the transfer, you want to transfer the Kiddushah from the copper coins back onto the nicer of the silver coins, because the sages have said you're allowed to go from silver to copper only under duress, like in this case where you have a problem because you don't know which of the silver coins it is. And not that you should leave it like that, you shouldn't leave it on the copper coin, but rather you're just using that as a temporary holding spot until you put it back into the silver. The point of this Mishnah is Katani Miyat Mechalalin Midohak, going from silver to copper is only under duress, but really the best thing is to put it into silver. In other words, if when you have a Deoraita law, and you have produce, the best thing, bring the produce, but you can't carry it. So then you should put it into a silver coin. That's the nicest and best coin. When you put it into copper, copper degrades quickly and is not as honorable. So if you have copper, you could upgrade to silver, but you shouldn't go from silver and downgrade to copper. So midochak in shalom midochak la. In this case, because we have a situation where the coins got mixed up, fine, you can use copper, go from silver to copper temporarily, just as a holding spot, and then go back to the silver. But otherwise, you wouldn't be able to do it. So we see from a deoraita level, one cannot go from silver to copper, and yet Rabbi Meir in this Mishnah in Masechet Demai says, if it's Demai, then we're more lenient. And you can go from silver to silver, copper. You can even go from silver to copper because it's just Demai. It's only Midrabanan. So we see that Rabbi Meir is lenient on the Midrabanan and he does not apply the rule that we applied to, that Shmuel applied to him, that says anything that is that the rabbis made asucha chamim chizuk ledivrehem kesher Torah, right? That was the principle that Shmuel used to answer for the Bimeir. But here is something that's demai; it's only the banan. And yet, you see, the rabbis are lenient, and they say, "Yeah, go for it. Go from silver to copper." Even though on a doraita level, you wouldn't. So that is Rav Sheshach's challenge to Shmuel. Amar Rav Yosef, afal pishem mekel the Bimeir bepid. Rav Yosef comes to the rescue and helps and answers for Shmuel. It's true that the Rabbi Meir was lenient when it comes to redemption and said, yeah, you can redeem from silver to copper because it's only the Midrabanan and Demai. However, regarding eating, he's Machmir. And our case in the Mishnah, remember, was talking about eating Terumat Maaser of Demai. And Rabbi Meir was stringent and said you have to add a fifth if you eat. If you're not a Kohen, then you eat it. So regarding eating, he's stringent. And here's a proof that Rabbi Meir is stringent regarding eating such things. Tetanya, lo hitiru limkor demai, ela lesiton bilbad. O ba'al ha'bayit, ben kach sarich le'aseh dibre Rabbi Meir. Siton is a wholesaler, merchant. He buys grain and things from lots of people, including some Ameha Aretz, and so it has the status of demai, and then he resells it to customers. Now, that the Siton is permitted, only he is permitted to sell Demai, and he doesn't have to take Terumah and Maaser because he's just the middleman, and everybody knows that whatever the status of the Siton himself is doesn't matter. He's getting things from Ameh Aretz, and then the final customer will be responsible to take Terumah and Maaser. That's true for a merchant, but that leniency does not apply to a homeowner, meaning a private individual who may engage in some commerce and he'll buy some extra and sell it. He may buy and sell, but that homeowner has to, no matter what, whether he buys a little or a lot, whether he buys in bulk because to resell, or he bought a little but now he has too much and he has to resell it, he didn't use it all, he has to take to the Ma'am Ma'aser even though he's going to resell it according to the Bimei Ir. The reason is simple. When someone buys from a wholesaler, he knows that the wholesaler got it from lots of people and the wholesaler is not going to take to the Ma'am maaser for everything, then he would lose out, lose his all of his profit. So the final buyer will take Terumah Maaser. But otherwise, if you buy from your neighbor, you assume that your neighbor, he's an upstanding person, that he took Terumah Maaser, and you don't assume that, oh, well, he just bought it from someone and is acting as a middleman because he is a final customer. So if it happens to be that he's reselling, I would assume that he took Terumah Maaser. Therefore, he has to take Terumah Maaser. That's the opinion of Rabbi Meir. Hachamim omerim echad asiton vechad balabait mocher vesholech lechabero venoten lo bematana veno choshesh. Hachamim are more lenient, and they say it doesn't matter if one is a professional merchant or if one is a homeowner. If any one of them are reselling or sending a gift to their friend of some produce, then the receiver can, then they can sell it without taking to the mama said, and they can assume that the receiver will know that they were acting as a middleman, and the final receiver will take terumah and ma'aser. So what do we see from here? That Rabbi Meir, when it comes to eating, and this is all demai, this whole thing is talking about demai, we're talking about where the original farmer, really the farmer is supposed to take terumah and ma'aser before he even sells it to anyone, before it gets to the wholesaler. So that's why on the Doraita level, we assume the farmer already did it. Now, just on the Drabanan, because there are some people are meha'adits and they don't take it, so then Chachamim say, okay, only the final person has to do it, but not any middleman. But Rabbi Meir is stringent, and he says, a bala bayit, who is reselling, has to take terumah and ma'aser. So we see that Rabbi Meir, although you're right, he was lenient when it came to redemption of demai, but he's stringent regarding eating. And the same stringency that you would apply to deoraita, you have to take it no matter what, so too he applies that stringency even to demai. And therefore, this is Rav Yosef's answer, and it explains, going all the way back, answers to Rabbi Elazar's question, right? Why is how come in the Mishnah we add a fifth even to someone who eats demai? Because this is Rabbi Meir, and Rabbi Meir is stringent. He's stringent regarding a get. And don't tell me, oh, but he's lenient when it comes to redemption. Yeah, that's free for redemption. You're right, he's lenient. But when it comes to eating, in fact, he is stringent. Okay, so far so good. We have an answer, but now we have a challenge. Mativ Ravina. Halokar min hanachtom ma'aser min hachama al hasonenet, min hasonenet al hachama. So here we have a Mishnah in Masechet Demai. Someone who buys bread from a baker. A baker is a local guy. He makes his bread. He gets the wheat. He buys the wheat. We assume he buys the wheat from one farm. And he bakes his bread, and so on. Someone buys from this baker. Now he has to ma'aser. He has to take the buyer has to take ma'aser, because who knows where the grain came from, and if it was already, or if ma'aser was already taken. Now when he does that, he can take ma'aser from different batches, one for the other. He can take from a warm batch, meaning that was just baked today, for the cold batch, meaning what he bought yesterday. And so he can separate the new one and then eat the old one. Or the other way around. He can separate from the old batch yesterday that got cold already, and say that was good, that these few loaves here are going to be ma'aser, and I'm designating as ma'aser to permit me to eat these new ones, these warm ones that just came out, just came from the baker. That you can do, old and new, new and old. And even if it comes from different molds, a baker would have different molds, different shapes, round bread and triangle bread, whatever bread. Even if it comes from different molds, which means that these were from different batches that the baker made. And so you know that they're for sure from different batches. Nevertheless, you can take ma'aser from one to the other according to Rabbi Meir. So here we see Rabbi Meir is lean in taking ma'aser, which is demai. Then you could take ma'aser from one thing to another. Now, bishlama min asonenet al chama kedir bi ilai. Damar bi ilai minayin letore min hara alay afash tizumate turumat teneemar. Lo tisu alav chet bahari mechemet chelbo mimenu. Imeno kodesh nisiyat chet lama mikan letore min hara alay afash turumato terumah. So to take from the cold for the warm, that is okay, even though you're giving to the Levi the older bread in order to permit the new warm bread, which is going down a level, still it is permitted and it would be, the terumah would go through. As Rabbi Eli says, Rabbi Eli now is talking about not demai, but actual deoraita ma'aser. If someone takes from something that's worse quality and gives that to the Levi to permit eating something that's better quality of terumah or ma'aser, then the pasuk says about that person, lo tisu alav chet, do not have bear a sin. How will you not bear a sin? By giving chilbo, by giving the best. So whatever you're going to give to the Kohen or to the Levi, you should give the best. Okay, that's true. So, and if you don't give the best, then you bear a sin. You're not doing something right. However, it does work, right? The terumah is terumah, and the rest of the food is permitted. Even though you bear a sin for not giving the best, still it is effective. Because if it's not Kodesh, if whatever you give to the Kohen or to the Levi is not holy, then what sin did you make? All you did was move some food around and say, I'm going to give this bad quality as a ma'aser for this good quality. But if it doesn't work, then you bear no sin because you didn't effectuate anything. You didn't give anything to anyone. So therefore, it must be that even if you give from bad for good, the terumah is in fact terumah. It's just that you didn't do the right thing because you gave something ineffective. So we see from here that giving bad to good is still effective. And for regarding ma'aser midoraita, you definitely shouldn't do that. For demai, okay, we can be more lenient. And so that's what Rabbi Meir says here. You can take from the cold to the warm and the warm for the cold. All that we understand, Rabbi Meir, there's no leniency here. However, ela filu medefusim harbe lechush dema tela frushe min hachiyuv ala patur min hapatur ala chiyuv. However, we cannot understand the Bimeir if he's upholding a deoraita standard even on demai and the rabbanan things. Then how can he permit taking from different shapes, from different batches, one for the other? Why doesn't he worry that he's taking from a batch that is liable to take ma'aser for another batch that you don't have to take ma'aser? In other words, if this baker, he got his wheat from different people, different farmers, and maybe one farmer took ma'aser and one farmer didn't take ma'aser. Now the baker, he made one batch of bread from the one that was already taken, so that is permitted food. And he took another batch from the other farmer that made his with grain that required it. And so now this requires. Now, if you have the different loaves in front of you, and you can tell that they're from different molds, from different batches, then you shouldn't be allowed to take from one to the other, because if I separate from something that terumah was ma'aser was already taken, I cannot use that to permit a batch that requires terumah and ma'aser. And so I'm going to take from something that is not required to something that is required. It won't work. And so this should be a problem. What do we see here? That Rabbi Meir is lenient because it's only demai anyway. So therefore, one can be lenient. And this is Rav Yosef's question. Ravina's question, right? That looks, Rabbi Meir is lenient even regarding a case of eating. And so why, if he's lenient here, then your answer that he is the author of the Mishnah and that's why he's stringent to add a fifth doesn't work. Okay, so that's the question. That's where we are so far. To review, Rabbi Elazar asked a question. Why is it, if it's Rabbanan, why at a fifth? Shmuel answers, because it's opinion of Rabbi Meir, who learned from a get, and he's stringent regarding the Rabbanan to treat it like the Oraita. Rav Sheshat asked about that. Rabbi Meir, we see he's lenient regarding Maaser to Demai to transfer from silver to copper. So you see he's lenient regarding Demai. Rav Yosef says, no, don't worry about that. That's only regarding redemption. But for eating, he's going to be stringent. Rav Yonah comes and says, look, I have a case of a baker where Rabbi Meir is lenient, even regarding eating when it comes to demai. So now we cannot understand why we don't have an answer to the Rabbi Elazar's question. All right, now Abaye is going to review his opinion about all the questions and answers we've had so far, but he will add his own response. Amar Abaye, Rabbi Elazar Shapir Kakashyale. First of all, Rabbi Elazar asked a really good question. Why are we so stringent regarding Tirumat Maaser of Demai? It's only the Rabbanan that you're going to add a fifth. Good question. Ushmer la shapir kamishanile de kashiale le rabbi Elazar mita de bide shamaim, mishanile shemuel mita bide mitat betin. Dilma shane mitat betin de chamira. I don't accept Shemuel's answer that, oh, this is Bimeir and he's always machmir on these things, because rabbi Elazar asked a question regarding Tirumat Maaser, which, what's the worst case? Let's say someone would eat actual deoraita tirumat maaser, a non-kohen, so his punishment would be mitabi deshamayim, heavenly death penalty, which is pretty bad. But it's not as bad as adultery. And so his answer, Shmuel's answer, would look at a bimeir regarding get, and there he is stringent and treats a get that has a problem mid rabbanan, he treats it like a get that has a problem mid deoraita. And he says the kid is a mamzer. Yeah, but there it makes sense for to be meir, to be machmir, because that is a sin that is punishable by mita bide adam, punishable by human court, capital punishment, which adultery is more stringent. So maybe to be meir treats a derabanan case of adultery like a deoraita case, because it's capital punishment in the hands of a human. That is not a sufficient answer for Rabbi Elazar's question, where the worst thing that could happen for Tirumat Maaser, if the non-kohen eats it, is only mita bide shamayim. So therefore, I don't accept Shmuel's answer. Now, I furthermore don't accept the Rav Sheshach challenge to Shmuel, even though I don't accept Shmuel's answer anyway. I also don't think Rav Sheshach had a good question. Rav Sheshat la shapir ka motiv le de ka amri in humita motiv Rav Sheshat lav dechtiv lo tuchal le'echol bish'arecha. Shmuel, he brought a proof from something that's mita, right? He is Rabbi Elazar and Shmuel. We're both talking about things that are the death penalty, although different types of death penalty. And Rav Sheshat brought a challenge from Maaser Sheni. That's the worst thing that can happen if you eat Maaser Sheni produce outside of Jerusalem. You're over alav. This is the lowest level of a lo ta'aseh. It's only alav. And so maybe Rabbi Meir was lenient when it came to, remember, redeeming the silver onto copper. He's lenient there because it's only a lav. And so that's not a question. I don't think Rav Sheshat's question is a problem. Well, my motiv Rav Sheshat, Rav Yosef, Shapir Kamishani Le. And in addition, I agree with, even if you would say Rav Sheshat had a good question, I agree with Rav Yosef's answer that Rabbi Meir, well, although lenient for redemption, is stringent for eating. Okay, that's his review of all the questions so far. And now the last question. Ela Ravina. Ravina, whose final question, that's where we're left standing. I have a challenge to Ravina. Ravina, he asked a question from a baker, in the case of a baker, and he was lenient and said, listen, if you buy it from a baker, then you could take the Tirumah and Maaser from one batch to another, and then you don't have to worry about it. You can be lenient. And Rabbi Meir says that. So we see Rabbi Meir is lenient when it comes to Tirumah Maaser of Demai. However, and that's a challenge. Look, he's lenient. How come he's machmir in the Mishnah, which is also Tirumat Maaser of Demai? So he says, why did you ask a question from the baker? He should have actually brought an answer and a proof from a palter. That is a merchant. That's a wholesaler who buys from many bakeries and sells a lot of bakery goods. And the law there, the Mishnah addresses ditnan halokher min palter maaser min kol defus udfus debred bimeir. When it comes to someone who buys bread from a palter, from a wholesale merchant, then the buyer has to take maaser. Now it's demai, because you don't know if the original farmer, hopefully we can assume that he took maaser back on the farm before he even got to the baker. But just in case he didn't, so midrabanan we have to. And yet the buyer from the pelater has to take from every mold, right, from every batch. Because because who knows where it came from, all this grain, and maybe one of them was patur, and one of them that he brought was chayav, and so you can't take from one mold to another. From each mold, you have to take 10% according to Rabbi Meir. So we see Rabbi Meir is actually strict. This is a case of Demayin, he's strict. Now, how do you answer the two cases of Rabbi Meir? Why does he make a distinction between a regular baker and a merchant, a wholesale baker? It makes sense. When you're talking about a palter, a wholesaler, he buys grains from lots of people. And because of that, we don't know where the grain comes from. And it's likely that some of the grain he buys, the farmer already took maaser. And some he didn't take maaser. And now he makes different trays, or maybe he's even buying from different bakers and they're all together. And now he makes different batches, and one batch you don't have to take maasir because it was already done. You can't use that and separate from that for a batch that you have to take maasir. So therefore, that explains this last Mishnah that you have to take from each and every batch. However, the case of Nachtom, which is the local baker, he only buys his grain from one person. He doesn't have all that much. So since he's buying the grain all from one person, so either that farmer took maaser and then you don't have to worry about anything, or he didn't take maaser, and therefore all of the batches that come from this bakery require maaser, and therefore you can take from one to the other. And so we see that there's a very good explanation for Rabbi Meir's leniency. It's actually not a leniency, it just follows straightforward because all of it comes from one baker, from one farmer, and that's why it can be lenient. However, if it in fact comes from different ones, then you have to be stringent. So now we have an answer to the original question. Why is our Mishnah so stringent to say Terumat Maaser of Demai, you have to add 20%? It is in fact the opinion of Rabbi Meir. So Shmuel got it right, except that Shmuel learned it from a get. And a get, that's too machmir, so you can't compare it to that, and you can't compare it to Maaser Sheni, which is more lenient. But rather, I'll compare this Terumat Maaser to another case here of taking Terumah or Maaser, which are both the same level as Terumat Maaser in the Mishnah. They're all Mitah Bideh Shamayim, if one eats it, who is not a Kohen. And you see that the Bimeid is in fact stringent, right? Because you see that with the Palter. And so this is a good answer. All right, all that is now one answer. We have one more. Rava says, you know what, go all the way back to the beginning, and I agree with Shemuel. And that which you asked, Abaye, against Shemuel, these are two different types of mitah. How can you bring a proof from mitah bide adam, which is more stringent? Rava says, that's not a problem. They're all called the death penalty, even though, yes, the subdivisions of different types of death penalty, but the subdivisions are relatively small, and therefore one can assume that whatever Bimei would say regarding one type of law that requires death penalty, he would say about the other as well. And just like Bimei, it is stringent regarding a get, even though it's only a requirement that a banani treats it like the oraita. We can learn that Rabbi Meir would say the same thing for terumah or maaser or terumat maaser, where in all those cases, if a non kohen eats tebel, where from which terumah and maaser and terumat maaser were not taken, then the punishment would be mitah bideh shamayim. So Rabbi Meir would be stringent about all those cases. And so Rava says, I don't need Abaye's answer. I'm going to go back and stick with Shemuel's response, and then the clarifications that come after are a sufficient response. And so we've explained our Mishnah is in fact a Bimeir, and why is it so stringent? Because the Bimeir says, yes, we treat even the Rabbanan, even things about Demai, you took Demai of Tebel, and that would be, if it was for sure, Mitah Bideh Shamayim, so one has to be stringent and treat it as if it's Doraita, and that's why you add an extra fifth surcharge.
Nu Mishnah, elu devarim she'en lahem ona ahavadim v'ashtarot v'akarkaot v'hekdeshot, en lahem tashlumei kefil v'o tashlumei arba'a v'chamisha.
In the following cases, there is no problem of ona'a. If someone is selling a slave or a deed or land or something that's hekdesh, even if one is overpaying or underpaying, there's no law. of ona'a. So, for example, for land, right? If someone says, you know, this land is actually worth $1 million and someone pays $1.5 million, then the sale is valid. Nobody can complain. Or a shtar would be like a loan document. A loan document, let's say, is for $100 that I have a loan that someone's going to, I can collect next year. And so I want to sell the loan document to you so that you can go and sell it. And you might buy that loan document maybe for 60 cents on the dollar because I want the money right away. And so then you'll collect it next year and you'll have to deal with the hassle of collecting it, right? Or avadim, or something that's ekdesh. That could be in a case where the Beit HaMikdash is selling property that they own. They're auctioning it off. And so if I overpay, I cannot come back and complain to the Beit HaMikdash. Or it could be a case of a consecrated animal that I have that gets a blemish, in which case I have to sell it and use the money to buy a different animal. And so if that gets sold for a price that's even more than 1/6, different from the regular market price, there is no law of ona'a. Not only no ona'a in all these cases, but also if someone steals one of these things, that thief does not pay double or 4 and 5. The 4 and 5 would not apply to slaves and deeds and land, but would apply to an animal that's hekdesh. If someone steals it and slaughters it or sells it, does not pay 4 and 5. Shomer chinam eno nishba venose sachar eno mishalem. If someone is watching one of these items, if it's a shomer chinam, normally he has to swear that he was not negligent. But if he's watching, let's say, someone's loan document and it gets stolen, he does not have to swear. If he's a paid watchman who normally has to pay, if it's stolen or lost, he does not have to pay. Rabbi Shimon Omer, Kadashim Shu Chaya Bacharutan, Yesham Ona'a, Vesheno Bachaya Bacharutan, En Lahem Ona'a. With regard to sacrificial animals, it depends. If it's a type that one is liable for, they're responsible for it. For example, if I say that I am liable to an ola, hare alai ola, and then I designate this thing, this one animal that will be an ola, and something, and then gets lost or stolen, then I have to bring a different one. So therefore, since I am responsible, I have a financial connection to it, and therefore that thing, if I sell, there is I am responsible for liable if I overcharge. Because even though it's hekdesh, but I also have a monetary responsibility over it. Whereas if it's an animal that I am not liable for it, if I say hade zo ola, I don't take the obligation upon myself, but I just designate that this animal is going to be an ola, in which case if it gets lost or stolen, I do not have to replace it because I didn't take the obligation upon myself as a person, but rather I just put the holiness on the animal. In that case, I have no connection to the animal, and therefore if I sell, let's say it gets a mum and I sell it, and I sell it for more than its value, the person who buys it cannot complain. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Af HaMocher Sefer Torah Behema Umargalit En Lahem Ona'a. Rabbi Yehuda adds some other things. If one sells a Sefer Torah, an animal, or a jewel, there is no law of Ona'a. Gemara on the next staff will explain. Amru lo amanu ela elu. But the other sages disagreed and said, no, only the items above are exempt from the law of overcharging, but not these things. What's the source that land and these other things? There's no ona'a. The pasuk in Vayikra that talks about do not overcharge, says if someone sells an item to his friend or buys from the hand of his friend. This is miyad amitecha. So we learn from there that overcharging only applies to a movable item that can be handed from one hand to another. That's going to exclude yatsu karkaot shenamitaltelim, a land which is not movable. You can't put land in your hand and give it over to someone. It's a curious derasha because the context actually is talking about land, that you can't sell land, let's say, in the 40th year of the Ovel for a full price because there's only 10 years left and it's going to go back. Nevertheless, even though the context is in fact talking about land, from this word miyad, we learn that the law of overcharging of 1/6 only applies to movable items. Yatsu avadim shukshu lekarkaot. Now slaves, although slaves are movable, but they are likened, they're compared to land and have a lot of the same laws for many things. Yasu shtarot ichtiv v'tchim timkeru mimkar shegufo machor v'gufo kanui. Yasu shtarot she'en gufan machor v'en gufan kanui v'enan omdim ela l'ra'aya shebahem. And the documents, we learn that since it says, if you sell a sellable item, that means something that itself, its body, is being sold and bought. However, with a deed, it's not the document itself, it's not the parchment that it's written on that's significant, but rather, this is just a proof for what's written on it. It's written on it that says, this guy's going to owe me $100 in a year from now. So it's the contents of it, not of the writing, and not the parchment itself that's being bought and sold, and so that is also excluded. We learn from here that if I sell my documents to a perfumer doesn't care about the contents of the documents, he only wants covers for his perfume bottles, and he's going to use the parchment as tops for it. So he is concerned about the parchment itself. And therefore, if I sell it to him for more than its value, there is, in fact, ona'ah. So you could have, the same item, a contract, and if I sell it for its written contents, then there's no ona'ah. But if I actually sell it to a perfumer who wants the parchment itself, and I overcharge him, then there will be ona'ah. We ask Peshita, isn't that obvious? Lapuke l'midirav kana damar en ona'ah liprutot kamash malan yesh ona'ah liprutot. We need this statement, we need that to teach us that we're going to disagree with the opinion of Rav Kahana. He said that in order to be liable to ona'ah, just overcharging someone peruta is not sufficient. It's a larger amount in order to be liable to peruta. We learn from here that even just a peruta of overcharging is considered overcharging. We learn it from here because how much is a parchment worth? One page of parchment. It's only going to be worth a few cents. So if I overcharge someone, 1/6 of that is still going to be just a peruta or two. It's not going to be a significant amount. And nevertheless, there is a law of ona'ah. Hekdeshot amar kera achiv velo hekdesh. Now, how do you know that ona'ah does not apply to holy items? Because it says if you buy or sell something from your friend, and so it means from your friend and not from another layperson, but does not apply to hekdesh. Matkif la rabba bar me'mal. Kol echad ichtiv yado mamash hu. Rabba challenges the first derivation here that has to be that we exclude land because that's not movable, that's not given from hand to hand. So what do you mean from something from hand to hand? Are you always taking the word yad literally, that it's literally something that you can put in your hand? This pasuk is talking about Sichon. When he conquered his land, he took all the land from the hand of his enemy. So is this something that you can literally take in your hand? Obviously not. Rather, it means metaphorically. He took possession of the land. Ela mirshuto achana me mirshuto. Since over there it means from his possession, so here also in this pasuk, we should say it means that if you take if you buy or sell something from the possession of someone else. So why don't we read it that way? And then it would apply to all things, including land. That is the question. So we challenge that. V'chol hechad ichtiv yado lav yado mamashu v'atanya imi maseti maseh b'yado en li ele yado gago hasero v'karpifo minayin t'mod omar im maseti maseh mikol makom. Wait a second, is it true that every time it says yado, then it means it's metaphorical, right? You're going the opposite extreme. But look at this baraita that says if a stolen item is found in the hands of the thief, then he has to pay double. So I only know if that's physically in his hands. What if it's not physically in his hands, but it's on his roof, in his courtyard, in his enclosure? How do you know also he would be liable to pay double? Because it says the word himaseh and timaseh, meaning being everywhere. So you see here that without the himase timase, we otherwise would take yado to be literally in his hands. Tamad chadar chamani himase timase halav hachi hava mina kol hechad echatav yado yado mamash hu. So we see here that unlike this pasuk in regarding Sichon, where we say, okay, here yado is metaphorical, but otherwise, that's true in that pasuk, but in other pasukim, we take it to be literal. Not only there, in another place, v'tu tanya, natan biyada en li ele yada, gaga chasera v'karpifa minayin, if a husband gives a get to his wife, he has to put it in her hands. Now, I only know that the get is valid if you put it in her hands. What if he deposited the get in her roof, courtyard, or enclosure? Tamadomar v'natan mikom akom, the word natan comes to add, yet in any, yes, in any place. So only because it says the word Natan, that's how I know other types of transfer to someone's possession work. But without Venatan, I would have thought that Yad means literal. So how come, so you see in these cases that Yad does mean literal. So we conclude that the word Yad means literally a hand. Except when it cannot possibly mean a hand. When it comes to Sichon, where it says he took all the land in his hand, well, that's impossible to physically do so. So there it's metaphorical. So we're going to take it literally, unless it's impossible to do so. And therefore, in our case of so since there it can be understood literally, so we'll understand it literally, and therefore it only applies to movable items. The question is, I know I'm not allowed to overcharge or undercharge when buying and selling things, but what about just renting an item? Does it apply there also? The pasuk does say mimkar, which means selling, but not renting, or maybe it's the same thing. Explains, does it say a permanent sale forever? No, it just says selling. And a rental is nothing but a sale for a short time, for a day. And so it is included. And therefore, if the normal rental fee for skis is $20 a day, and you charge a person $30, so then that would be overcharging. Ba'e rava chitin uzra'an bekarka mahu yesham ona'a o en lahem ona'a kima deshedya b'chada damyan v'yesham ona'a o dima batlinu al gav ar'a. If someone has some wheat kernels and he puts them in the ground to sows them in the ground to plant them. So what about that? And let's say someone then sells the land, you know, with this, is I put these seeds in it also, and he overcharges. So what do we say? Is there ona'a regarding those seeds or not? Here's the two sides. Do we say that the seeds are movable items? They were movable items, and so just putting them in the ground is the same as putting them in a jug, right? Because they are movable items, so it does apply. It does not apply to the land, but it does apply to the kernels. Or do we say, once you plant them in the ground, then they are batel to the ground, they become part of the ground, and therefore, just like there is no ona'a on the ground, there is no ona'a for this on the sale of the seeds either. Now we ask, kechidame ilem adamar ihu shadai bat bashita v'atu sadev amri la dela shada ba elachamisha v'amarav akol dva shemidah b'mishkav sheminyan afilu pachot mechidei ona'a chozer. So what is the case? If it's the seller, let's say, says, I put 6 kav of grain in the ground, right? And I'm selling it to you, and so here's the price. And then witnesses come and say, no, he didn't put 6, he only put 5. But in that case, Rava said, anything that is measured by weight or number, even if it's less than the 6 different, then the sale gets returned. Because if it's a fixed amount, let's say I say I'm going to buy from you 1,000 paper clips, and then you give me 999 paper clips. Now, even though this is less than 1/6, it's very, very little bit. But you, it's a number. You said 1,000, and you only gave me 999. So then I could say, no, you this is the transaction is reversed. You didn't fulfill what you said because it's a fixed number, and so therefore that cannot be the case, because then surely we would know the answer that it would be on it would be reversed. Ela damari ushadai bi ba kedebaela veglamelta de la shada ba kedebaela. Rather, it's talking about a person that says he hires a worker and he says, listen, put in the number of wheat kernels that's required. He didn't say a fixed amount, but just a general, right, as is required. And then turns out witnesses say, no, he didn't put the required amount. So that's the case that I was talking about, where let's say he sells that field and it does not have sufficient amount, but not by an exact number. No, he never said an exact number, but rather a general amount, and it turns out to be more than 1/6 of a difference than what would be expected. So is there ona'ah k'man d'shti b'chadah d'myan v'yeshlam ona'ah od yom abatlinu agav ar'ah? So in that case, do we say that these are movable items because they're kernels, so it's like putting in a jug or putting in the ground is the same thing, and I thought I was getting this much and I got much less? Or do we say that once it's put in the ground, it becomes batel to the ground and there's no ona'ah when selling land? Nishba'in, that's one question. We're going to ask more questions. We're going to take on all of them. Nishba'in alehen or en nishba'in alehen. Would one have be required to give an oath, like let's say a modebe miksat oath regarding kernels? Generally, you have to give modebe miksat and other types of oaths on movable items, but not on land. So kiman deshedem bechadat damyan nishba'in alehen or dilma batlinu agav al'av en nishba'in alehen. Do we say that there's like they're in a jug, even though it happens to be in the ground, but they're movable items and you make a vow? Or do we say no, that it's a batel to the ground? So that's the next question. This could be a case where an owner hires workers to put the grain in the ground and he says, hey, you didn't put any, and you're supposed to put 100 grains in the ground, and then the workers say, well, we put 50, right? So they're modeb and miksat, they did some, but they admit that they didn't do everything. So would they have to give a vow for that modeb and miksat? Well, it depends if you consider it like a movable or like land. And next question, Omer Matiran or en Omer Matiran. When you bring the Korban Omer on the second day of Pesach, then all grain that has been harvested, even grain that has just taken root, is then permitted, right? Even if on the second day of Pesach it's already taken root, even though it didn't grow yet, when eventually it grows, you can eat it that year. However, any grain that has not yet taken root, one will have to wait all the way till the next year when you bring the omer, and only then one can eat that new grain. So hechidame. So now we're asking this: these seeds, what's the law regarding them? Are they like movable items, or are they like part of the ground? Hechidame. I di ish te ashrus tenena. I de la ashrus tenena ditnan. Im ishishu kodem la omer omer matiran. Im lav isuran. So now we ask, what kind of case are you asking the question in? If it took root, then we know the answer. And if it didn't take root, we also know the answer, because we learned it both in the Mishnah Menachot that says, if they took root before the Omer, then they're permitted that very year. And if it didn't take root, then they're not permitted. So what are you talking about? And the answer is, La sericha de chasadin hu zra'in hu kodem la Omer, vata le Omer vechalif ilavaihu, vela shrush kodem la Omer. Mahu leminkat umechal minaihu, keman de shadyan bechadad ameh, vesharinu Omer. So the law about grains is that let's say they have this grain and I want to eat it. There's a difference between eating it and planting it. If I'm going to eat it, so this comes from last year's crop, so I'm allowed to eat it. This is permitted. So that would be no problem. However, once I plant it, and so now if I designate this to be planting, then it becomes prohibited, because now it's part of the ground, and certainly when it takes root, it's definitely part of the ground, but even before it takes root. All right, so that is the question. If I take some wheat kernels and I plant them, now at that point they're part of the ground, and so the law would be, if it takes root, it's permitted this year. If it doesn't take root, it would be permitted only next year. However, then I change my mind and I take it out of the ground, around and I want to eat it. So now what? Do can I now designate this as food kernels and not as growing kernels? Well, it depends. What do you consider that putting in the ground? Is it like putting it in the jug? It just happens to be in the ground, but it didn't take root yet, so it's not part of the ground yet, and therefore I could eat it. Or do we say once I put it in the ground, it becomes part of the ground, it becomes batel, and therefore it would be forbidden, and we leave all these dilemmas unanswered. Baruch Adonai Le'olam. Amen v'amen.